Well, I would like to welcome everybody to the third lecture of the Thinking Out Loud Lectures in Philosophy and Society series. It is our great honor to have as our speaker for the inaugural series, Professor Stathis Gourgouris from Columbia University. Professor Gourgouris is talking on the theme of secular criticism. The first lecture really concentrated on the notion of criticism and how, Professor Gourgouris understands the notion of criticism himself. And the second lecture looked at ways that secularism is understood in relation to atheism and other concepts. So the lecture today is titled Political Theology and Prohibition.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming here on your Friday evening. I hope that I can make the time that you're taking worthwhile. As I told you last time, every one of these lectures is quite different in style and even subject from a certain perspective. This one perhaps exemplifies more than any other the thinking out loud command, because it is still an unfinished piece. I'm reading a kind of a fragment from a longer piece that's still not finished. And it would involve three parts. One is definitely brief meditation on political theology, both historically and as a concept. Then a discussion based on a particular quotation that I will read from Greek-French philosopher Cornelius Castoriadis about iconoclasm and idolatry and the prohibition of images. And it will end with some reflections of iconoclasm in contemporary art, particularly the issue of underrepresentability in the work of Maurizio Cattelan, who is an Italian contemporary artist. So the transitions are not entirely worked out, so bear with me. I'll be very happy to elucidate the gaps that might emerge in the discussion. Okay. Since the term political theology broke heavily into the academic theoretical scene, I wouldn't quite date that with the advent of the Carl Schmitt obsession, but rather with the secularism obsession, which emerged about 10 years ago. I've been talking about that. I felt that the term which political theology overtook and silenced was not political theory, as Paul Kahn argues in his recent book, Political Theology, Four New Chapters on the Concept of Sovereignty. The book is really a reading of Carl Schmitt, but rather the term political economy. The eclipse of political economy as a primary interpretive concept is all the more stunning given the dire circumstances of our day, when the economic sphere has come to occupy the political in undisguised fashion. While since Marx's days we had known that economic interests ultimately determine the political trajectory of societies, we now have come to see economic agents explicitly exercising governmental power. I can go into examples if you like. They're probably quite obvious. I call this the deregulation of the political. The naming is, in fact, ironic. Deregulation has always been, even in strict economic terms, about specific, partial and stealth, but nonetheless hardcore, regulation. In other words, invisible rules in the name of no rules, whose benefit is not only to maximize control of the game by those who gain from it, but exterminate those who oppose them. So in a context where the economic is exercising explicit regulation over the sphere of the political, while simultaneously effacing political economy from the language of social and historical analysis, it seems even more problematic to me that the political is ever more thought to be determined by the theological. It's not only that the famous Carl Schmitt quotation, which is, I'll repeat it, you may have heard of it, all significant concepts of the modern theory of the state are secularized theoretical concepts. So it's not only that this famous quotation seems to be circulated ad absurdum as fact. it is that even in its own terms, it has been irresponsibly considered. To say that something has been secularized, grammatically speaking anyway, is to mean that an action has been taken upon this something, and that this something, the theological in this case, has thereby been altered. Secularization is an alteration of the forms and conditions of the theological, which is not to say the annihilation of the theological, but it is neither to say the mere repetition of the theological in other guise. While we are fond of saying that history repeats itself, it most brutally doesn't. And it is precisely history as finite action that makes even the apparent repetition of form in actually a shift from tragedy to farce, or however we want to think of it. As elementary as this point is, it is indicative of a profound lapse in the proliferation of Schmitt's dictum in the present secularism debates. From this standpoint, although theological elements continue to abound in contemporary societies worldwide, they're neither primary, nor have they always existed in strict historical terms, all the more so in relation to the political. As a concept, historically speaking now, political theology is a Christian notion. Though the name is first encountered in Stoic philosophy, it is given there the significance of one category of politics among many, and by that token, the theological is merely an account of specific elements of service to statecraft. It is only when the Roman Empire refashions itself as a theologically endowed regime that the term begins the trajectory we are now debating. Eusebius of Caesarea, the first historian of Christianity, is also the first to fashion the idea that the transportation and transformation of Roman Imperium to Byzantium is the historical and political actualization of what is theologically announced in the biblical texts. There is an intricate nexus here, especially the relation of Eusebius' position with the theological arguments about God's Trinitarian consubstantiality, to be precise, that brought about the decisions of the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD, which form the theological and legislative foundations of Christianity until the schism in the 11th century. Significant, but not possible to address here because it's a huge topic, I'll be happy to talk about it though, is especially the famous dictum of Gregory of Nazianzus in his third theological oration, this is 379 AD, that the Trinitarian arche consists of the notion, I quote, the one being in stasis with itself, το εν στασιάζον προς αυτό, an extraordinary notion, not only as the epitome of the Christian theological imaginary, and altogether explicitly of how political theology is necessarily monarchical, because it is about the one, but also more broadly, in its equally explicit contradistinction from the ancient Greek philosophical and political vocabulary that enables it to begin with. There's a great deal to be said, obviously, about the fact that the Greek language is the one that's the philosophical language is being used in early Christianity to elaborate concepts that are quite different philosophically. However, it's in the hands of Augustine, as is well known, that the horizon of political theology is enhanced with a transcendental teleology, the substance of which has yet to be conceptually outmaneuvered. The city of God is still the last instance of political theology, whatever name might be invented for it in the course of time, and the various social historical languages deployed. As last instance, philosophically speaking, the transcendental civitas Dei is the limit point of the concept of political theology, making in this sense the political ultimately subordinate to the theological, an instrument of the theological, as is after all grammatically all too evident. Political is just an adjective to the substantive theology that it qualifies. Historically speaking, however, political theology is from the outset, and long before Carl Schmitt came to exist upon this earth, a theology understood to be grounded and constituted against an enemy. This enemy would have to have both theological and political dimensions, although this is not to say that the two are necessarily dialectically entwined. The political history of Christianity is exemplary as a political history of the concept of enmity and has come to infect its historical enemies with the same logic. While the transcendentalist element in political theology is thus outmaneuverable and primary, the usage of political theology in different epochs, including our present time, testifies simultaneously to its insurmountably worldly character. Now, thinking from the nodal perspective of this naming, political theology the way I've been arguing, two crucial sets of questions emerge that need to be asked. These two sets of questions are of a different order, but are indeed linked by a demand to focus our interpretation on the political. First, is theology necessarily political? That is, can we speak of an apolitical theology? And what would this mean? How would apolitical possibly stand on its own, that is, undetermined by the political? And moreover, can we really speak of theology as such, unqualified, unsubstantial, without an adjective, that is? If the answer is no to any of the last two questions, then the emphasis in the original question inevitably falls back on the issue of necessity. Is theology necessarily political? This, I believe, is the bottom line in the discussion of what might be signified by the name political theology and in the uses that it's had so far. If indeed this is the case, we need to ask, what are the terms of this necessity? What terms authorize this necessity? My tendency would be to say that such terms cannot be merely theological, strictly speaking. That is, we cannot speak of an internal history of political theology as a formal philosophical concept. Second question. What is this politics enacted by political theology? Can we speak of a politics in this paradoxical singular plural way, that is, of a certain kind of politics, which can nonetheless be manifested differently according to historical specifics? All the more so given that political theology remains articulated unquestionably in the singular. We don't hear of political theologies. I mean, there's a book by that title, but that stuff is rather academic games. Huh? The term political theologies doesn't exist. There's only one. Why is that? The question of whether political theology is monological or not is for me an outmaneuverable dimension of the problem. We cannot assume an agreement on this issue, but we cannot go ahead without seriously encountering it as a question. If, in fact, political theology enacts a specific politics, regardless of the theological or historical content, then a whole other can of worms is open. I venture on an answer, by conviction, but also for the sake of argument. Schmitt is again a crucial reference point. I've always argued that Schmitt's notion of sovereignty as decision on the exception entails a monarchical theory, literally speaking, not in terms of royalty. Certainly, in his book Political Theology, which was published in 1922, I believe, a purely juridical book, he calls it later on, Schmitt conceives sovereignty explicitly as singular arche. And it's elementary to say that the radical democratic imagery that honors Aristotle's dictum that no ruler can rule without the knowledge of being ruled and vice versa could not possibly be entertained in the Schmittian universe. But I would go further and argue that this literally monarchical element permeates all theories of sovereignty, including those advocating popular sovereignty like Paul Kahn in his recent book, that see the sovereign position as extra dimensional of the polity. In this sense, one could paraphrase Schmitt's famous dictum in political theology to say instead that's my phrase, all significant concepts of the modern theory of the state are residual monarchical concepts. This might give us a better sense of why I assert that political theology has meaning only within a monarchical, that is to say, monological, monomythical, and indeed monotheistic imaginary. Let us remember that Schmitt writes his second political theology treatise practically 50 years later, in 1970, not at all as a sequel, despite the name, but as a response to his critics, primarily to a long essay by Catholic theologian Eric Peterson, written in 1935, so even there's a response 35 years later, which is a treatise on monotheism as a political problem. And here both the date and the specific focus point to a response to the monarchical dogma of the Führer principle, which Schmitt acknowledges, though not quite in his words. And second response to Hans Blumenberg's contemporary critique in a book, very important book, called The Legitimacy of the Modern Age, which was published in 1976. It's one of the most interesting and important books on the issue of secularization. But it is actually the second text, Blumenberg, that authorizes Schmitt's impetus to take on the first, Peterson, thereby expressly staging an argument with a theologian as a political rather than as a theological matter. If monotheism is a political problem, according to Peterson, Schmitt seems to suggest that political theology is not about monotheism, a shrewd shift of the framework of the argument and very typical of Schmitt's tactics. Hence, he predicates his argument on the assertion, and now I quote from Political Theology 2, Schmitt, this is his quotation, "Political theology is a polymorphous phenomenon with two different sides to it, each directed to its specific context, political theological. This is already given in the compositum of the phrase," he says. "There are many political theologies because there are, on the one hand, many different religions, and on the other, many different kinds and methods of doing politics." Now, I don't know how familiar you are with Schmitt, but I can tell you, one does not suddenly discover a relativist Schmitt. So this passage requires an equally shrewd reading. I don't have the time to conduct it here. I'd be happy to talk more about it, but I would like to draw our attention to the centrality of the compositum, as he calls it. I've always found insightful the assessment of the great German playwright Heiner Müller that Schmitt's thinking is exemplarily theatrical. He is a political thinker, for some the thinker of the political, and simultaneously, though in a furtive way for many reasons, driven by a theological desire. The two are in constant agonistic relation. The compositum is precisely the staging of this agonism, disguising a compromise formation. I will address shortly why I'm using this term. For Schmitt, political theology, though a concept delineated in the singular, becomes by the 1970s text a performative domain, which thereby, by virtue of its very performativity, is articulated as the work of myth. Schmitt explicitly applauds Peterson's suggestion that political theology is a myth, albeit by turning against Peterson's negative signification of the notion of myth. For Peterson to say that political theology is a myth is a bad thing. Schmitt argues, no, it's a good thing. Without invoking Georges Sorel, whose work he knows profoundly, Schmitt essentially here adopts a Sorelian notion of political theology as the myth necessary for the specific socio-historical and political action, in his language, remember that's juridical, and that he demands in most of his World War II texts. The problem that needs to be investigated in depth, and I'm just announcing it again, as I told you, this is a fragment of a piece, is in what sense this mythical performative, even in Schmitt's staging it in Political Theology too, can outmaneuver the transcendentalist imperative of a politics that desires to be theological above and beyond all, that by virtue of this untamable desire can never in fact be democratic. Now I come to the second part of this essay. Bit of a leap, but you'll see the connections. Now, for years, I've been fascinated by a couple of sentences in an essay by Cornelius Kasouriadis called Institution of Society and Religion. The essay was published in 1980. I quote this phrase, "Every religion is idolatry or is not socially effective religion. In religion, words themselves, sacred words, function and can only function as idols." So I want to think about this sentence. The unequivocal phrase, "every religion is idolatry," comes with an explicit qualification, or it is not socially effective religion, thereby underscoring religion as a societal, indeed, we can easily say political issue, rather than as a theological problem. In this sense, the mysticism that might produce an abyssal language in which no idols can remain standing can never be by definition socially effective, can never be a social binding force. Mystical practice configures instead a social unbinding, a rejection of society, and aims at its most extreme, at the incapacity of worldly assembly. This isn't to say that the unintelligibility of mystical language is not socially readable, as many people, particularly for me, French critic Michel Desserteaux has inimitably shown. It is to say that however society might be able to read this unintelligibility, it nonetheless cannot but turn it into an idol, thereby turn against it, read it as another language, and by another language. Now I'm reading from Castoriadis' quotation. The mystical relation to the abyss, whether it be an authentic or hallucinatory phenomenon, does not matter here. There never was and there never will be mystical religion or a religion of mystics. The lives of mystics themselves function as instituted simulacra of the abyss. That's the end of quotation. So how often socially effective religion, so-called, has turned mysticism into dangerous idolatry, even while bestowing sanctification to specific practitioners, is one of the key indications of how far it goes to deny its own idolatrous investment. Castoriadis' unambiguous signification of religion in this fashion is actually the result of thinking about representation against the grain of traditional use of the term. For Castoriadis, I quote again, the need for religion corresponds to the refusal on the part of human beings to recognize absolute alterity, end of quote. This is primarily an ontological problem, but the question of capacity or incapacity of encounter with alterity, with otherness, is entirely a matter of the social imagination. I should clarify, even if absolutely briefly again, that in Castoriadis' language, absolute alterity is an immanent, not transcendental condition, a radical otherness within a self who is forever torn between, on the one hand, the compulsion for self-reproduction, which is the identity principle, and the necessity for internalizing the resolute otherness of the world, and that's the capacity to alter and change, become someone else, something else. While the first is ontological at the level of the living being, that is to say, no one can live without the identity principle, the second is always configured according to the specific social imaginary at work. Responding to this existential predicament, society produces a compromise formation. That's now Castoriadis' term, which is why I used it before, that emerges out of the refusal to recognize absolute internal alterity so as to cover over this refusal, so as to fill its void, and in this respect, unwittingly, to fulfill it. Before the so-called secularization process, this fulfillment of the refusal of abyssal alterity that produces a precisely circumscribed and socially meaningful alterity accounts for what he calls religion. Religion, then, is instituted in order to counter the abyssal terrain of being, the fact that there is nothing in human existence that presupposes it or exceeds it, that human existence is at the limit, groundless, and all established meaning fails it. This abyssal condition, is of course unrepresentable, unlocalizable, and meaningless. It may be perhaps intelligible in, let's say, the desacralized language of psychoanalysis that speculates, because you can never really know, and Freud said that explicitly, that speculates on the abyssal constitution of the psyche, but even there, the object is at the core, the object, the psyche, unrepresentable, unlocalizable, and meaningless. Castoriadis concludes, I quote again, religion covers the abyss, the chaos, the groundlessness that society itself is for itself. Religion negates society's radical imaginary and puts in its place a particular imaginary creation. It veils the enigma of the exigency for meaning, which makes society as much as it is made by society, insofar as it imputes to society a meaning that would come to it from elsewhere. End of quotation. In this respect, to put it bluntly, I quote again, society creates itself, and to begin with, creates itself as a heteronomous society. End of quote. This utterly paradoxical condition is not open to simple explanation, which is why all pseudo-sociological or pseudo-psychological theories about some sort of structural or hardwired propensity in human beings towards heteronomy are utter nonsense. Surely, such theories never seem to wonder about the epistemological position from which their investigations or explanations are promulgated. They don't seek to explain how come they conduct and achieve a self-understanding that comes from elsewhere, and doing so as conscious self-understanding simultaneously obliterate this knowledge. Theologians, certainly in the monotheistic traditions, have been performing these sorts of contortions for centuries. The inordinate genius for self-occultation that characterizes some of the most glorious and most brilliant manifestations of the theological mind over time testifies to the fact, and I quote again from Kasuriadis, the enigma of heteronomous society and the enigma of religion are in large part one and the same enigma. Now, one may raise the counter-argument that this essentially ontological signification of religion, because it pertains to general anthropology, we're talking about the human being as such, remains silent about the social historical emergence of the very concept or name religion. This name, the counter-argument would go, might be said to be inscribed with the secularization claim and all its politics, namely the geopolitical establishment of Christianity as the world's dominant religion, which claims to go beyond religion so as to emancipate itself from that constraint while relegating every other such mode to it. For those who make the latter argument in a broad range of ways, in a great number of people, from our French political theorist Marcel Gauchet to Talal Assad, about whom I spoke on Monday, from Tomoko Masuzao, who is a religious historian, to Gil Aninjar, who is a dear friend of mine and a very brilliant guy. Nonetheless, I disagree with him. The question of secularization is, in a sense, false or deceptive. A ruse by which Christianity erases itself as religion in order to establish the realm of religion for all others. While I think this argument does have merit, and in fact a great deal of historical accuracy, it is ultimately short-sighted and indeed compromised by its unwillingness to consider the essential animating force of what has been called secularization, namely the desire of human beings to relieve themselves of their own self-imposed constraints and confront the consequences of encountering the cosmological abyss without safeguards. Whether or how far this desire has been realized is actually not the issue. Secularization, I've been arguing for some years, is unfinishable by definition. The cosmological abyss cannot be encountered once and for all. We cannot be done with it. So although one could again raise the counter-argument that all kinds of other safeguards were indeed put into place as a result of secularization, constitutions, nations, ideologies, scientific truths, or utopian dreams, the fact remains that all those new delusions ushered by secularization were acknowledged to be human creations, for better or worse, thereby shifting the knowledge framework so as to enable the thought that religion, too, may be understood as a human creation. Even if secularization can be disputed as having occurred at all, whether according to Schmitt's argument or the work of the thinkers I mentioned, the shifting in the framework of knowledge cannot be disputed. Regardless of the persistence of the faithful, the world around, some number among the world's population, indeed it's impossible to measure precisely, understands that religion is one glorious, if sometimes perilous, human creation among many. But in the end, what one thinks of secularization is secondary. Religious practices under different names seem to have existed in all societies in known history, even if their exact domain of significance is both enormously varied and inordinately contested. Religion as one separate category of social formation among many, which would be a notion that would be enabled by secularization, is at this point an epistemological domain in itself. We have religion studies, we have history of religion, and so on and so forth. This is to say, it is religion as categorical or perhaps cognitive framework that enables the recognition and naming of a certain typology of practices that we call religious. And if this distinction is itself a symptom of the secularization process, it doesn't matter. Or rather, it is a matter of historical understanding, of an emergent horizon of perception that enables the recognition of religion as a human creation. And it is this latter aspect that concerns me here. As human creation, religion is a social practice of encountering and concealing the abyss of existence. What Castoriadis calls socially effective religion, which for him is the only meaning of religion as we saw, is the outcome of creating a name, a representation, or a locus for this abyss of interminable self-created otherness. Though such creations are oftentimes concrete material objects, icons, statues, totems, sacred texts, they are equally likely and offer more powerfully to be abstract and immaterial. The word become flesh, the unpronounceable name of God, the 99 names of God, the transcendental absolute, the goddess reason, and so on. Yet in all cases, such social imaginary creations that constitute the space of the sacred are idols, reified simulacra of the abyss they represent by concealing. This is the sense of the polemical statement, every religion is idolatry. To the extent that religion is not merely the representation of society's desire to ritualize its existence and not is restricted to an individual's mystical claim to merge with the abyss, but is instead the institution that occludes the groundlessness of existence as such and thus builds an imaginary institutional scaffolding on which society may find rest, then the workings of religion are essentially psychic, which is not quite psychological, and indeed not unlike those of sublimation, where all invested representations are categorically objectified, be they images, words, or cognitive abstractions. I talked about that in the discussion on Monday, and I'd be happy to return to it. This is why, for Castoriadis, even in those cases, when religion emerges from the foundational monotheistic injunction, the Bildverbot, the prohibition of images, idolatry is fully at work. Now, in order to succeed, the exercise of Bildverbot, the prohibition of images, which conventionally may have had Hebraic origins, but remains the core principle in all monotheistic imaginaries, even if performed on extreme occasions. Think of early Christian monophysites, Byzantine iconoclasm, Franciscan or Calvinist asceticism, strict Islamism or Protestant fundamentalism, must involve a rather narrow construct of image in its most literal sense. Bild, in German, essentially comes to define the object of representation as such, as an object that must be identified, known, and forbidden by virtue of representation, as representation. Nominally, the prohibition is against images that dare to represent God, if only because then they will be endowed with divine properties in themselves and be worshipped as such as divine objects, idols. But underneath this nominal logic, what is really prohibited is the very act, the very conception of representation, the daring to give God a form, since in the monotheistic imaginary, only God forms, or better yet, God is form and the only agency of form, of which humans are thereby the exemplary byproduct. This is expressly denoted in the extraordinary notion of humans being formed in God's image and God's likeness. The Greek words translating the Hebrew of Genesis are ikona, image, icon, and omoiosis, sameness, likeness, which may be thought of insofar as it has as it has always been invoked polemically against paganism, the explicit rollback of anthropomorphic divinities by nonetheless absorbing the principle of icon and likeness, and thereby, perhaps maybe in a Hegelian sense, preserving it by altering the core principle. Namely, if God is form, then the project of human formation is theomorphic. Humans are the form of God in image and in likeness. Yet the human being cannot ultimately tolerate itself as God or godlike, thereby projecting backwards an anthropomorphic notion to the category of God, who may not necessarily look like the statue of Zeus, as it would have been sculpted by Praxiteles or Phidias, but is nonetheless imagined, since the monotheistic imaginary is and can only be a patriarchal imaginary, as the Almighty Father, in however abstract or concrete manifestation a specific social imaginary can handle. There's much to say here, in light of this sketch, about the validity of Kasariadze's provocative assertion that the institution of religion is, and I quote, the supreme hubris of human existence, an ontological hubris. That's what he says. It's provocative because the commonsensical assumption is that hubris is committed when humans believe they are or act like gods, not when they invent or create gods. But indeed, to imagine gods presiding over the universe is one of the most extraordinary acts of human creation, an ordering of the universe by an agency that hereby becomes conspicuously and conveniently absent. It is hubris precisely in the denial of accountability for this act of radical creation, which, as radical creation, remember I've said that before, is always an act of destruction. Now, to imagine, moreover, a single God, who creates humans in image and in likeness, is an even more formidable ontological hubris, if it is at all semantically possible to produce a quantitative figure of the ontological. Not only does it confer the creation, and of course meaning of being, to an entity of the imagination, but also authorizes the very category of being, big capital, which thus leads to the perverse inversion of subject-object authorization, whereby the subject deliberately objectifies itself in the most outrageous denial of its own accountability for creation. Worse yet, the object, the created God, is now named eternal creator, the ultimate other, the object who has become the subject without subjectivity, who moreover proceeds with a monopoly of the means of production of the human as the unavowed creator now configured as created in image and in likeness. This perversely contorted process facilitates outrageous notions of grandeur. Not just the concept of the chosen people, absorbed into all, secularized or not, nationalist imaginaries, but the notion that the human, made of or as the face of God, is in the last instance of divine essence, a notion whose consequent psychic energies, I would argue, belie the worst excesses of both humanist ideology, in the traditional sense, and religious fanaticism. This is a stunning performance in the history of the human animal as a living being that renders even the human imagination itself paralyzed before the awe of its achievement. In this respect, the prohibition of images has built into it a powerful injunction against both form and representation as such, an injunction that seems to resurface with extraordinary urgency whenever the desire of humans to aestheticize their universe seems to gain the upper hand. In the process, another big question emerges. What is the relation between Bildung and Bildverbot? Now, this is in many ways a German question, crucial to the development of German philosophy, indeed both the theological and anti-theological strains in it, but it is also a question crucial to the imaginary of modernity. I take Bildverbot to be the core element underlying the Protestant imaginary, which may be distilled into the notion of Geist without Bild, not merely spirit without image, but spirit that cannot be formed into an image because of an assertion, which is passed on through theology to modern philosophy, that image ultimately despiritualizes matters. The project of Bildung, at least the way it was conceived in Wilhelm von Humboldt's mind, and Bildung, for those of you who may not know, is the name for what we really now know and understand to be modern education, and a kind of a cultivation of civilized being, okay? Early 19th century educational reforms. So the project of Bildung is a worldly project. Self-formation is a process that creates both the human being and the human world. It is not a spiritual quest, except insofar as spirit, in German Geist, means also mind and intellect. Freud's famous notion, Geistig Guide, which, let us recall, is the only possible redeeming value of the prohibition of images, and this explicitly against the perils of monotheism, which Freud, in his Moses and Monotheism in the Beginning, he identifies as the singular cause of religious intolerance and religious violence, is, of course, a Bildung, a poetic process of forming, of creating form against the prohibition of form. This process is linked to what Castoriadis has named the radical imagination, that is, the primary social historical process of enabling the creation of form in advance of those institutions of society charged with reproducing form, one of which, of course, would be education. I'll read this quotation. I'm worried a bit about time, but I will read it, otherwise it won't make sense. It's his quotation. The term radical I use first to oppose what I'm talking about to the secondary imagination, which is either reproductive or simply combinatory, and second, to emphasize the idea that this imagination, the radical imagination, lies before the distinction between what is real and what is fictitious. To put it bluntly, he goes on, it is because radical imagination exists that reality exists for us, and that it exists as it exists. Hence, an understanding of the imagination as the power to represent what is not opens the way of reconsidering the relation between image and representation so that the first is not in the service of the second. My argument would be, it's not the image as representation, but the image as signification that animates idolatry. In this sense, then, a possible undoing of the prohibition of images would rest on a reconfiguration of Bild, of the notion of image, so that image would be disengaged from the discourse of representation, precisely because we are dealing with the creation of images that produce the heretofore unseen and unknown, images that conceptualize and signify the heretofore inconceivable image that represents nothing and exists prior, the thing that is thereby created into existence. To reiterate, not only is image to be disengaged from the discourse of representation, but more so engaged from the standpoint of formation and transformation. For this reason, words themselves are primary imagistic units of signification. I should clarify here that my sense of Bildung exceeds its traditional meaning. In this configuration, Bildung ceases to be a self-identical process whereby the self comes to fulfill itself, and this was how Humboldt, as an idealist, envisioned it. Because once the concept of self is no longer the agent of closure, Bildung becomes the very instance of the force of interminable self-otherness, recreated through critical self-interrogation as performative pedagogy. This leads us back to the discussion we've been having in the last couple of days. Therein resides its democratic element, its participation in the project of autonomy. Democratic education conducts itself on the premise and purpose that self-interrogation shatters strict self-referentiality. This is in reference to also realizing what the question Dimitri you asked in the first session. Now, the prohibition of images is a radical notion only when it operates in a desacralized universe. This was, of course, Freud's aspiration. In a monotheistic universe, iconoclasm merely reorients idol worship from the utterable and representable to the unutterable and unrepresentable. You can also say from the tangible to the intangible. The prohibition on pronouncing the name of God is indeed an idolatrous act. Disregarding this fact is a grave error, although indicative of the self-denial inherent in the logic of religious iconoclasm. Making the name sacred circumscribes in this gesture of erasure, of voiding, the very abyss thus announced. The sacred prohibition of the name is a name, an act of naming, of localizing in an immanent sense the abyss that must and does, by virtue of this naming, remain shielded. Likewise, the ritual of the Eucharist is not idolatrous in the sense often considered, that is, as a remnant of paganism in the evocation of animistic eating of the divine body. Rather, the metaphoric configuration of flesh as bread and blood as wine is secondary idolatry. In my mind, literally a superfluous idolatry, a repetitive pleonasm. The most brilliant and perhaps insidious gesture this ritual generates is to conceal the real idolatry at work, the conjured phantasm that God, who otherwise cannot be known, who has no name, who exists in ways unfathomable and unrepresentable, can indeed be part of you. In other words, the ritual of ingesting God into one's being, even if altogether metaphorically, reveals precisely God's idol status, which is his real, that is to say, his actual status. In this case, the status of an idol that claims to destroy all idols, or perhaps all other idols would be the most precise way to put it. These sublime tricks exemplify the work of the sacred in social life, a work that in the last instance must remain secretive and literally a mystery. In contrast, a desacralized universe of meaning reconfigures the meaning of both iconoclasm and the sacred. In a capitalist world, where the image is inevitably linked to the rule of commodities and the tyranny of exchange, iconoclasm does become, in effect, a de-theologizing gesture. It's only then that iconoclasm calls into question the idols of the tribe, as it were, the stipulation that in every society there is a last instance that cannot be questioned and, of course, cannot be represented. Whatever content this last instance may have, whatever language, symbol, sign, convention, whatever may be identified as the idols of the tribe, it is society's last instance of the sacred. Now I come to my last and very short section on art. There is a whole strain in modern art that vehemently sought after this capacity to expose society's last instance of the sacred through an iconoclastic strategy which paradoxically foregrounds or hyper-privileges the image. The Dadaist tradition, and certainly the irreverent performativity of Marcel Duchamp, could easily come to mind. Far from being deconstructive, Duchamp's ready-mades are iconic renamings. They don't bar the image in order to preserve the ideal sacred of an allegedly non-commodified space. Rather, they desacralize the contextual space of the image. For if commodities are extensions of religious idolatry, as Marx argued so long ago, they are not so in themselves, but insofar as they render sacred their means of existence, the space of capitalist exchange. This was also the impetus behind situationist performativity and Guy Debord's critique of the society of the spectacle. However, Debord's conviction that the spectacle had reached beyond mere visual excess and become objective reality led him into the whirlwind of yet another round of Bildverbot politics, which inevitably propels one to seek yet another space of the sacred ad infinitum. Much can be learned in this respect from the art of Maurizio Cattelan, who, unlike many of his contemporaries, seems especially aware of the deadlock of avant-gardist responses to the commodified image which breed an idolatrous aesthetic sacralization in the name of iconoclasm. It's easy, of course, to characterize Catalan's notorious irreverence toward the entirety of the art world and its media, agents, galleries, exhibitions, patrons, fellow artists, publications, market publicity, and so on, as iconoclastic. That this can be said without much thinking is itself indicative of the profoundly ingrained and thoughtless use of the term iconoclasm. But Catalan's work, in its shameless irreverence and outrageous provocation, including explicit artistic deception or downright art theft, to the extent that many are considering him not to even be an artist at all, shows quite the opposite. Namely, it is impossible to exist in a non-imagistic universe, and that to presume so is not only naive, but tantamount to the triumph of consumer capitalism's metaphysics of the image, a metaphysics that ultimately denies people's imaginary capacity to think otherwise. Hence, Catalan's commitment to overt proliferation of undisguised simulacra, resin wax or taxidermic reproductions of iconic living being. Some of his art, or a good part of his art, is exactly that kind of thing. Now, the artist's 2011 retrospective at the Guggenheim Museum in New York, with which he announced his retirement from the art world, we don't know what that means really, brought forth this problematic in acute, even dramatic form. Catalan chose to exhibit almost every one of his art pieces over the years, the exhibit is entitled All, by decontextualizing them to an extreme, in full cognizance of the fact that all the retrospectives are dependent on decontextualization. That is, and I'm describing what he did, by hanging them all from the museum's ceiling with steel cables, in no apparent order, as an assemblage of cadavers in display after a hangman's mass execution, a literal signification of the core of one's artwork as corpse. This much could be expected in retrospect from an artist whose almost every artwork has been to showcase its death in order to animate some other, often outrageous, irreverent, or even non-existent, image of the living environment that enables art to exist at all. But the experience of winding up and down the museum's notorious rotunda, you have to imagine the Guggenheim Museum here, in order to get a circular view of this enormous hanging corpse in multiple parts, surely aggravates the perilous presumption of artistic iconoclasm for its own sake. Iconoclasm on the gallows may be an apt distillation of what this exhibit was all about. Yet, what makes this exhibit so radical is that in strangulating artistic iconoclasm, it also exposes and thus incapacitates, in a sort of simultaneous double death, the latent idolatrous gesture of the presumed secular spectator. The fact that arguably the most iconic of all of Catalan's reproductions, exercised against what is conventionally considered to be the icon against idolatry par excellence, the Pope, was received as the most scandalous of all his works, should hardly surprise us. His 1999 depiction of Pope John Paul II in full regalia, stricken and incapacitated by a meteorite, titled indicatively La Nona Hora, the Ninth Hour, in a derisory invocation of Christ's moment of death on the cross, was vandalized when exhibited in the Pope's native Poland in 2001. It's easy to say that such vandalism signifies the enraged response of the faithful who are responding to the injury of blasphemy. This was as well the consensus around the controversy over cartooning the Prophet Muhammad in the Danish newspaper Gilas Posten in 2005. But I believe we learn nothing by such platitudes. The more difficult thing to engage in my mind as a point of inquiry is that such a rage is directed against what is perceived to be an idolatrous gesture, therefore propelling nominally iconoclastic action, while at the same time, even if unwittingly, expressing the most idolatrous investment in the unrepresentability of the object of worship, which thereby bars it from the realm of art. Such investment is idolatrous in the sense that it is precisely this exclusive mode of worship that turns this object of worship into an object that can be seen even when it is not represented. We witness here a perverse logic. Self-acknowledged iconoclasts rage against an iconoclasm that they perceived as idolatry, not recognizing that their own idolatrous desire feeds their iconoclasm. We can speak of antagonistic idolaters, perhaps, though this is admittedly cavalier, because neither the faithful nor the faithless recognize idolatry at all. Now, I come to my conclusion. It is here that the political workings of the concept of unrepresentability become crucial. In this respect, much can be appreciated in the French theorist Jean Crassier's argument in his book The Future of the Image, that the image plays in a field between the visible and the sayable. This confirms my argument here in reading Castoriadis. It is image as signification, not as a representation, that animates idolatry. Ranciere artfully navigates this terrain in order eventually to raise the stakes on the phantom that haunts the entire discussion, the presumption of the unrepresentable. Even when invoked in the discourse of material history, or perhaps especially there, the unrepresentable event, the claim to unrepresentability is the apotheosis of idolatrous metaphysics. It is moreover a self-annihilating gesture whose internal debilitating contradiction is occluded by the unacknowledged denial of what is a moralistic negation of the sensible, of the untamable desire to configure one's sense of the world, even in its abyssal manifestation in some form. Now, permit me to quote, I am coming to the end, extensively from Ranciere's passionate conclusion, because his words, I should not paraphrase, they're quite great in this sense. And I quote, "The assertion of unrepresentability claims that some things can only be represented in a certain type of form by a type of language appropriate to their exceptionality. In a strict sense, this idea is vacuous. It simply expresses a wish, the paradoxical desire that, in the very regime which abolishes the representative suitability of forms to objects, appropriate forms respecting the singularity of the exception still exist. Since this desire is contradictory in principle, it can only be realized in an exaggeration, which, in order to ensure the fallacious equation between anti-representative art and the art of the unrepresentable, places a whole regime of art under the sign of holy terror. In order to assert an unrepresentability in art that is commensurate with the unthinkability of the event, the latter, the unthinkability of the event, must itself have been rendered entirely thinkable, entirely necessary according to thought. The logic of the unrepresentable can only be sustained by a hyperbole that ends up destroying it." That's the quotation. The obvious, and I think indisputable point, is that nothing is unrepresentable, because whatever signifies it as unrepresentable must configure its unrepresentability in some form, even if entirely in the realm of the sayable. But it's more important to understand that nothing is representable or unrepresentable as such. Surely nothing is unrepresentable as long as humanity exists. The very encounter of humans with the abyss of the world, at least since the time that is marked by what went on inside the caves of Lascaux, seems to make representation a necessity. But what is curious about the human animal is that the same capacity that seems to make representation a necessity, which we could say it's the psyche's ultimate propensity for fantasy, also propels the demand for the unrepresentable. The phantasmatic commitment to the unrepresentable is animated by the same force that seems to make representation a necessity, the vital propensity that posits no limits as to what can be represented. Once we conceptualize this coincidence, and thus deconstruct its alleged paradox, we can understand very well that nothing has ever been beyond humanity's capacity for representation, because the nothing itself has been persistently an object of representation. Perhaps the most coveted object of all, the ever-nagging kernel of both philosophical and theological thought, whose most forceful renditions have been the inordinate claims to its unrepresentability and the altogether real and often violent action to defend the materiality of such claims. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Gurgur.